I got a note. Well, I've had several notes, but this one was just a comment by somebody on our discussion yesterday about courage, and I thought that made some good points, so I thought I'd just read it, and since I don't know who sent it, I can't tell you, wouldn't tell you, and I hope it doesn't embarrass them. It says, courage is a perfect mark of leadership to begin with. You can't even begin to become a leader without having the courage to become baptized in front of your congregation. You can't be a leader without the courage to stand up in front of the congregation to teach, lead songs, pray, etc. I believe fear of having attention on them in front of the congregation is keeping several young men from being baptized. I read that because I thought there were some good thoughts. Now, I might amend them just a little bit, and I imagine this person would be agreeable, but I don't know. Certainly it does take courage to get baptized in front of your whole congregation. But that's not the only way one can be baptized. All through the book of Acts, people were being baptized whenever the urge or the conviction came to them. So I would say if you make a decision to be baptized and it's a while before the church is going to be gathered together, I would always recommend whenever you make the decision, that's the time to do it. And certainly getting up in front of the group does take a little bit of courage, but I think we're all leaders, so even if you can't do that, you don't get out of being a leader. But I thought it was a couple of valid points in this, and we need to be careful that we don't put pressure on people to do some public things that maybe just they aren't ready for. I wouldn't want that to keep anybody from being a Christian. But I appreciated the comments. Also, after class yesterday, I had a conversation with an individual that I found very edifying. And it started out with a couple of questions of which this person, I think, had kind of thought through and developed answers. But I thought they were good questions. I just eliminated half of you. Is being an effective leader equal to being a good leader? And the question, my first response was yes. In order to be a good leader, you have to be an effective leader. But as we discussed it, it became apparent, at least in my mind, and I think in his, that you can be an effective leader and not be a good leader. Satan is a very effective leader, but Satan is not a good leader. All good leaders have to be effective, but not all effective influencers, which is the way we're defining leadership, are necessarily good leaders, unfortunately. And then we talked a little bit more, And the question came up, can a courageous leader also be a bad leader? And I think the answer to that is yes. I'm going through some of the marks of leadership, and yesterday it was courage. I think in order to be a good leader, you have to be courageous. But simply being courageous alone doesn't make you a good leader. So, and probably almost all of these marks, if you isolated them by themselves, you could still be a bad leader. But they are things we need to become good and great leaders. So I enjoyed both of those comments and discussions, and they iron sharpened iron, and I felt like I got something out of those comments and those discussions. Before I get into my next mark of leadership, just a couple of reviews, and we've got some people that haven't been with us. The most succinct definition that I know of for leadership is influence. If you influence people, you are a leader. And I believe all of us, like it or not, influence each other. I thought of Titus chapter 2. You remember the first few verses in Titus chapter 2? He exhorts the older men to teach the younger men and the older ladies to teach the younger ladies and the young men. What's that all about? It's about those who are more mature in the faith positively influencing those that are younger. And that's leadership. And he didn't say, elders, you do it, or elders' wives, you do it. He said that to all of us that are of that capacity. So as I begin to look at this, I'm now looking at Titus chapter 2, at least the first half a dozen or so verses, as verses on leadership, as well as some specific instruction as to our responsibility. We may come back to Titus chapter 2 because I've gotten several questions and it's in my outline that I have in my head. We're going to talk about how do we train, how do we reproduce leaders? Well, I think Titus chapter 2 is a good starting place, but that's not my agenda for today, so I'll just leave that. Before I get in, well, let me finish this slide. You can be a bad leader, good leader, great leader. You can't be a non-leader. It's just not an option. Somebody is always in charge. Today I'm going to spend my first part of our session on another mark of leadership. And we're going to be talking about delegating and delegation, because I believe all good and great leaders must delegate. And I'll explain why. Not that you disagree with that, but we'll look at some biblical principles. But before that, I'd just like for you to think, stick in the back of your mind this couple of questions, then I'm going to come back to it after I'm done with my comments on delegation. How many of the congregations represented here have regular business meetings? Okay, how many of you that have business meetings would describe the attendance of those meetings as poor? I'm not going to name any names, just be honest. Okay. Well, even those of you that didn't raise your hand probably have experienced that. My question is, why do we think our business meetings are poorly attended? I don't want you to answer that yet. We're going to discuss that after we get through with our other discussion. But I think that there may be at least some potential insights as we go through this. Leadership and delegation. For a church to be what God wants it to be, it requires the energy and the efforts of all of its members. Now, most congregations are not ideal congregations, so not all members, not all parts of the body, exert the energy that they could. None of us exert that all of the time. I was leaving where I'm staying, and one of the people that's staying there as I left said, "Do your best." And it occurred on me, I probably hardly ever do my best. I never reach that 100%. Sometimes I'm a long ways from 100%. But that should be our goal. Sometimes members make mistakes, but that does not mean they are not needed. Leaders challenge the rest of us to excel. Leaders are people who can take those of us that are ordinary and make us extraordinary. Now again, remember, you and I are both led, but we are also leaders. So we have to have two hats at various times. But it's that teamwork that enables a common man to do uncommon things. I had the privilege 12 years ago of going to Egypt, seeing the pyramids. I still don't quite understand how those were made, but I know it took a lot of teamwork. I don't care how much power Pharaoh had, he couldn't have built those pyramids by himself. It took a lot of manpower. I don't care how good the leadership in your congregation is, they cannot do the maximum that your congregation can do by themselves. Solomon couldn't make the temple by himself. No one person made the early church by themselves. And no one or two people are going to make any congregation today. You simply cannot rely simply on genius, because genius is in such short supply. I'm not even sure we can rely on smart, because I find smart to be relatively rare on some days. But leaders challenge us ordinary people to perform better. But too often in the church, we have a few doing the most. I don't want a show of hands, but how many of you are at a congregation where the 80-20% rule seems to apply? 80% of the work gets done by 20% of the people. Well, we sometimes say that's the way organizations are. That's true, but I don't believe that's God's plan for the church. As much as I appreciate the 20% who do the 80%, that is not God's plan. And I don't think it pleases God. So why does that occur? Why does the 80-20 or 90-10 or 70-30 rule so often apply? Well, it occurs to me there are a couple of reasons, and there probably are more than two, but I wrote up two. One of them is just sloth, which is a King James word for lazy. There are people who just don't want to do anything. And the other reason sometimes might be our unwillingness to get them involved, i.e. delegation. And yet, when I look at scriptures, God appears to me to be the master delegator. C.S. Lewis wrote, "God seems to do nothing of himself which he can possibly delegate to his creatures. He commands us to do slowly and blunderingly what he could do perfectly in the twinkling of an eye." And isn't that true? He could snap his fingers and the whole world would be Christian. But he doesn't do that. He delegates to us to take his word to them. And I'm sure he's got good reasons. Efficiency doesn't seem to me to be one of them. So there must be other things for us to look at. I want to talk a little bit, and I consider delegating an art of which many of us are not very good at. And believe me, being a type A personality, I fully appreciate our frustration. You know, for those of us that are doers, and I don't mean that to be egotistical, those of us that are type A's, the thought that runs through our minds is, it's so much easier to do it ourselves if you want it done right. And that makes a lot of sense. Almost. It seems to me like when we get into the area of delegation, we have to ask ourselves a real basic question. Do we believe in and trust the people we are leading? Because delegating requires that we believe in and trust the people around us. If you do not believe and trust the people around you, then delegating can be a suicidal activity. It also is an issue of the battle of control versus trust. Control versus trust. Remember I mentioned that 80-20 rule? How many times have we heard or been maybe in the 20 and said, I just wish other people would do more? Well, sometimes I think that's true, but sometimes I think we say that and don't really mean it. Non-delegators often have several characteristics. Now, if you have some of these characteristics, it doesn't mean you're a non-delegator, but these are characteristics that maybe will help us analyze ourselves so that for the purpose of becoming better leaders. Number one, non-delegators tend to be hoarders. Now, a hoarder is different than a collector. Marvin Ingle is in no way, shape, or form a hoarder. Everything Marvin collects is very, very important and very, very valuable. Right, Marvin? Yeah. But hoarders take things irregardless of their value. That's the difference between a collector and a hoarder. At least a collector thinks they're valuable. Hoarders just collect them because they don't want to let go of them. Well, I might need that nail in the next 10 years, so I'm not going to throw it away. And I've not been in your garages and your basements, but it's full of those. And ladies, you're no better. But you're all lovely ladies, so I won't give a specific. Secondly, many times non-delegators tend to be a perfectionist or have perfectionist tendencies. Now, I can't relate to that one because I am not. But perfectionists want things done a certain way. And it's hard for them to accept them being less than ideal in their opinion. Therefore, they're going to tend to say, well, if it's going to be done right, I better do it. I remember vividly a few years ago, I was staying with a family. He happened to be a deacon at the time. And there were some songbooks, red songbooks, that the binding had kind of, they needed help. So we got You know, the old duct tape fixes anything. So we got a roll of duct tape and all these song books, and we were going to rebind them. I thought, well, I'm just here, and it was daytime. I wasn't preaching or anything, so I'd help him. So I was helping him. And his two grown sons looked at me and said, with that, that's a mistake, John, look. But I thought, I can do this. So I helped him, and I did well. The problem is the tape needed to go at a 90-degree angle. And my tape went at an 89.9-degree angle. And he gave me a couple of looks that told me it was time for me to go study. He was a perfectionist. He did the rest of them himself. And he was happy. But it was hard for me to help him. Thirdly, non-delegators sometimes are what I would call obsessively checkers. And that means that they just have to look at every minutia to make sure it's just right. If there's a misspelled word, not on the page, if there's a misspelled word in the whole book, they'll find it. And it has to do a little bit with perfectionists. And they also tend to be methodically functionaries. And by that I mean everything is methodically lined out. My wife and I went to visit her uncle in St. Louis a few weeks ago, and their daughter is what I'd call methodically functional, because her parents, she had them keep their dog while they went on a trip, and she brought over this day timer, and at 9:15 you take the dog out, at 11:42 you feed the dog, at 12:05 you take the dog out again, and you know what I'd have done to that dog, but she just had it so lined out. She felt the need for them to keep the dog, but she couldn't delegate. Obsessive and compulsive traits do characterize many leaders. If over-directed, volunteering becomes rote and boring. Therefore, volunteering will decrease, and delegation will also decrease. Leaders must cultivate a fundamental belief in the people they are leading. That is the basic, I think, of delegating. If you do not believe and trust the people around you, you will not delegate them a particular task. But if you do not, those around you that you could and should be leading will usually dry up and quit and fade away. True delegation occurs only when there is a required and a reciprocal sense of faith. The members must have faith in their leadership, and the leadership has to have faith in the membership. Working together, it is this mutual faith that allows individual members to grow and have confidence in their abilities. This, in turn, provides energy for growth. Delegators must believe what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20. Now unto him that is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us, unto him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages. Unto him that is to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask, and according to the power that worketh in us. That has to do with trust and with faith. Let me ask you, in the New Testament, who would pop to your mind as a classic non-delegator? Who pops in your mind, not in the Old Testament, that's pretty easy. In the New Testament, who would be a classic non-delegator? Somebody I thought said it. In his early life, that wasn't the one I had in mind, but in his early life, that could well be. Paul? No, I think Paul did pretty good. He turned things over to Timothy and various ones. Someone said Peter and somebody said Paul. That's the two I've heard. Diotrephes is the one I had in mind. 3 John chapter 9, he wanted to have the preeminence in the King James. So what's that mean? He wanted to be in control. He was a control freak. And therefore, John coming in would have meant he had to delegate some of that control, and maybe in his mind, and he wasn't well received. And it was a anchor, an anvil around that congregation, wasn't it? I'm going to now turn to Exodus chapter 18. Not because it's unfamiliar with you. Students of the Bible, you would think we'd need to talk about Jethro and Moses on the subject of delegation, and you're right, and we will. The advantage we have here is you're somewhat familiar with this issue. Great leaders delegate. Good and bad leaders often do things on their own. Now in verse 9 of Exodus chapter 18, Jethro pops into Moses' life. And it's interesting, as we go through these verses, Moses is going to learn a tremendous lesson from a non-Jewish man. Now, that doesn't mean non-Jewish men aren't intelligent, but the tenor of that society is that most of the wisdom would come from within. But here's a non-Jewish man that's going to teach Moses a very familiar lesson. He's teaching Moses a key lesson on leadership. Verse 9. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. Jethro, his father-in-law, was happy for the Exodus. And Jethro said in verse 10, Blessed be the Lord who hath delivered you out of the land of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know, verse 11, that the Lord is greater than all gods. So Jethro is a Yahweh supporter. For in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he is above them. And Jethro's, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat with Moses' father-in-law before God. Now look at verse 12, and I don't want to be reading more into this than is, but who, at least we're not told, who does not come to this feast? We are not told that Moses came. Now Moses may have come, but it doesn't say that. I wonder, in the context of the subsequent verses, if Moses maybe wasn't so busy administering to the needs of the people that he didn't feel like he had time to come. I don't know. But that could be why this whole incident rears its head right after this feast. Now you don't have to accept that because I can't prove it, but it's worth thought. Verse 13. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat at the to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from morning to evening. Moses was judging the people, and he couldn't get it all done. And it just went from morning to evening, and I'm sure in the evening he had people left over that had to come back the next day and then the next day. For the sake of time, let's drop down to verse 17. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, The thing that you doest is not good. Now Jethro was a shepherd, but apparently a very intelligent man, and he could see that Moses' activity of trying to do it all wasn't working. Moses had, fortunately, as we go through this chapter, the wisdom and teachability to accept the counsel of his father-in-law. I don't know where I first read this, so I know it's a quote, I just don't know who to give credit for it. Someone said, I'd rather put 1,000 men to work than do the work of 1,000 men. Well, the reality is you can't do the work of 1,000 men. You can't do the work of 10 men. If there are 20 people in your congregation, you're better off putting 20 people to work than trying to do the work of 20 people. Because you can't do the latter. You won't get all of the former, but you may get a significant amount. Another quote, and again, I apologize, I don't know where this first came from. One who does, rather than delegates, may do many things great, but leadership is not one of them. If you are a doer and a non-delegator, you cannot be a great leader. It can't be done. I'm not even sure you can be a good one. But I am confident in my own heart you cannot be a great one. Leaders are naturally good at things. That's how they became leaders. In your congregation, your elders, your deacons, are elders and deacons because they were good Christians and good at getting things done. But when you become a leader, whether it's of a family or a congregation or all of us in our leaderships, you can't always just stay a doer. You can't just stay a doer. Well, you can, but not if you want to be a good or a great leader. Now, Moses was good at administrating, but that didn't mean he should do it all. I think I made this comment, I paraphrased it yesterday. It came up in our discussion. Leaders are responsible for seeing that things get done, but they are not responsible for doing it all. In fact, good leaders don't do most of it. They see that it gets done. Now, when I say that, that doesn't mean we delegate so we can put our feet in on the chair and go to sleep while other people work. No, it means we delegate so they can do that while we can go on to other things. And I'm scrambling my notes up, but that's okay. At least it is for me. I wonder if sometimes the reason we as leaders, and that's all of you, don't delegate is that we don't want to give up that task because we might have to do something that's a little harder or we don't enjoy as much. Let me ask you, what would you rather do? Vacuum your church building? Or call on a delinquent member? If you're honest, most of us would rather vacuum the church building. Let me ask you, which would you rather do? Go to church on a Saturday morning for a work day or canvass the neighborhood? You ever notice that when you have work days, you'll get X number, and when you canvass the neighborhood, you'll have X minus some number? Now, there may be aberrations of that, but sometimes I wonder, we don't delegate because we don't want to give away comfortable things because that gives us time and no excuse not to get to the uncomfortable things. When you go to time management workshops, and many of you have been to them, some of them will say put your stuff in these colored folders and then do the most important first. Well, that all makes sense, but I never liked that. I like to do the easy stuff first so that maybe I'd be time to come home before I got to the hard stuff. Now, I didn't do that consistently or I would have been without a job, but you know what I'm saying. You know, we've got a lot of introspection to do. Where was Moses? Moses was teachable. I think I've just gone over this. Some of the principles from Jethro's advice, and I don't think I need to spend a lot of time going through this with you, but I'd like to capture them. Without God, all delegation will be ineffective. If you notice there in the 18th chapter and in the 19th verse, it says, "Hearken now unto my voice," Jethro speaking, "I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with you." This Jethro was quite a guy because he knew just his counsel wasn't going to solve the problem. God had to also be with Moses. Secondly, one of the principles I get out of Jethro's advice is that we need to focus on our primary tasks. Verse 20, "And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws and shall show them the way therein." Moses, that's what you're good at. Moses, your primary job is to teach them the laws and the ordinance and show them the way. These other people can do these other things. Jethro wasn't saying, "Moses, you need to delegate so you don't work so hard." He was saying, "Moses, you need to delegate so you can focus on the most important tasks." Does that remind you of Acts chapter 6? It's exactly the same principle. It wasn't that the apostles in Acts chapter 6 couldn't have ministered to the widows. It's just that they needed to delegate that so they could move on. Would have delegating to the widows been a more comfortable task for the apostles than maybe some of the things they did? Sure. Not more less important, but more comfortable. And to accomplish God's primary goals, leaders must delegate other needs by selecting qualified people to aid in the work. That is an extremely important issue, and I had it later, and let me find the verse that I want there. If I can, if not, I'll just grab it later. But I'll tell you the principle, and it's in this 18th chapter. Moses did not go out and say, okay, I'm overworked, could I have some volunteers to help me? He did not do that. Now, there are some tasks where that is the appropriate thing to do, so I'm not being critical when that's appropriate. But this was a task that you don't just take volunteers. He sought out, King James says he provided, but it means he sought out men who had the skills to do the task. When you delegate, it's not simply giving it to somebody. Give it to somebody who you have confidence in being able to do the job. At my home congregation, if the plumbing needs to be fixed, nobody in that congregation is silly enough to call me. They know better. You've heard me say this, but when something goes wrong at our house, two things happen. I run for my little red plastic toolbox, and Donna runs for the yellow pages. And she's getting very fast, because she's seen my little yellow toolbox. And it doesn't fix things. We all have talents. So when we're delegating, it's not simply asking for volunteers. Have you ever seen a case, and it happens in congregations, where someone will ask for a volunteer, and someone will volunteer that's not really the right choice for the task? Now what do you do? You know, if you ask for volunteers, that's fine, but just be ready to accept whoever volunteers. And there are some tasks that you don't want volunteers. You want to go at, and there are some people who won't volunteer, but would be happy to do it if they're asked. There's a lady in our congregation who had never taught that I know of. And this has been a few years ago. I must have still been an elder there, but I don't really remember. I must have been. And we were just saying, why doesn't she ever teach? And I don't know why, but I just went up and asked her if she'd like to teach. She was thrilled. And when I said, well, you'd never taught before, you never asked me. Well, shame on us. Now, I know sometimes elders ask us to do things and they don't get the response they'd like to have. You know, sign-up sheets are good, and please, I'm not talking about out there, but some people just aren't volunteerers. They're willing. I notice here Moses chose these people. Chose these people. Is it verse 25? Yeah. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people. In Acts chapter 6, they chose them. They didn't say, who wants to provide for the widows? Now, might have worked, but there's a reason that they didn't do it that way. I'm just saying, sometimes asking for volunteers is a good way to give everybody an opportunity, but there's sometimes delegation is more of an active thing than a passive thing. Thank you, Eldon. Benefits of delegating, very quickly. I think there's an obvious benefit to the leader. Obviously, in this case, in Exodus 18, Moses was relieved. But it can be a benefit to the leader, to us. But it can also be scary. Remember, sometimes we don't want to give up those more comfortable tasks. Obviously has a benefit to the people. And by that, I'm not talking about the person that gets delegated to. In Exodus 18, the people's needs were being met more quickly once Moses delegated this to some of the other chosen men. I think in our organizations, in our congregations, in our families, when we delegate, we can just get more done. See, the issue is not allowing our leaders to pull less, it's the issue of having more of us pull the wagon so the wagon can get bigger. I'm not interested in making any of our workloads lighter. I'm really not, because I don't think any of us are, very few of us, if any of us, are overworked. We just need more people to pull the wagon, not so we can pull less, but so we can pull more. That seems to me to be the biblical model. And obviously there are benefits to the doer. We'll talk more about this later, probably next week. But I think this is a key element in developing our future leaders. Delegating to see what they can do and for them to grow. When do you grow? It's when you're doing something. Who's getting the most out of this class? Me. Who gets the most out of the class or whenever you do something? Me. Which congregation in the United States is getting the most out of this two-week meeting? Vandalia. They're going to be tired. Now, they already are tired. But they're getting the most out of it. Leaders remain responsible, but often should not remain the primary doers of these tasks. I wrote down another quote, and I tried to massage this to make it just a little more politically correct, but I like it, so I'm going to do it without. So just take it with a grain of salt. It's not mine. Jeff Miller came up with this. If your organization, congregation, is constipated, you may be the obstruction. And delegation may be the enema to relieve it. Well, at least you're going to remember it. Maybe. But we can become our own obstructions by wanting to do not too much, but too much. And other people don't grow. Again, we should and must be personally be responsible for tasks, but not necessarily the ones doing them. This meeting, the officers, the congregation delegated to the teachers, gave us a little guidance, but not terrible much. It's not that Greg and Charles and Doug and Mike couldn't have taught, but it frees them up to do other things that maybe we wouldn't have known how to have done. But leaders have to remember that there are limits to the expenditure of physical forces beyond which it is not safe or wise to go. One of the benefits of delegating is to avoid burnout. To avoid burnout. Most of us are far more closer to rusting out than burning out, but a few of you may battle with burnout. Okay, I'm not done with delegation, but I put this slide in here to remind me to stop and ask the question and seek your input. Why is delegating so difficult for so many of us? Why is delegating so difficult? Thoughts? Norm? Nobody did it the way I did it. Is that implying nobody can do it as good? Okay. He said nobody did it the way he did it, or maybe nobody did it to his satisfaction, using him in a generic sense, not specifically him. Nobody will want to, so I might as well not even ask. You've been rejected repeatedly, so why even try? Tom?
I think it's the hardest.
He said one of the hardest things he's found turning from a worker to a leader, and I know what he means by that because leaders are still workers, but I know what you mean by that, is letting go of stuff. Yeah, there are babies, in a sense. It's a lot like parenting. Somebody once described one of the best descriptions I had for raising a teenager. You know, the teenager's the lifeboat, and you got a rope, and you're hanging on, but you got to gradually let go of the rope. If you let go of it too fast, you lose them. If you hold on to it too tight, you get rope burn. And it's a real judgmental thing. David and then Dwayne.
I just know working at GM, we had to be taught, physically taught, that you can accomplish 10 times as much with 10 people working as you can with one of you. You have to go through that experience to realize the value of that kind of delegation.
Yeah, there's been a lot of men and women who have ruined their health and their family lives because they wouldn't delegate. And I'm probably in the church too, Dwayne. Yeah. Delegating is counter... No. Sometimes delegating seems counterproductive. But in reality, delegation is the only way to become productive. But we struggle with that. Remember that's that joke about, you know, when a man goes to buy a lawnmower, he only asks two questions. How much does it cost and can my wife run it? Well, that kind of delegation may cause you a little bit of strife. But if you don't like to mow the yard, then I guess that's easy to do. Anybody else have? I'm not peripheral, so. Greg?
I have to redefine my goal. It doesn't matter. What you deliver to me as a delegate may not be what I had in mind. I'd be willing to adjust my goals.
Okay, it may cause us to readjust in our goals and our thinking. Okay. I'll take a couple more. Janice?
I know leaders who are afraid to show up because they don't want the other person to listen. They don't want to be revealed that the other person can do it better.
She said she's known leaders who are afraid to be showed up and don't want someone else to do it better than they can. Absolutely. I'd like to say that never happens in the church, but I believe it does. But in the workplace, have you ever seen someone who would... Who would consistently not hire the best people? Oh, I have. And that's insecurity. It takes a very secure person to hire the very best people he can hire because he may be hiring people better than he is. But that's a leader. A leader doesn't have to be the best. He has to have the best. But that's a hard lesson for us to learn. Okay. I'm sorry, Sam.
I think sometimes the problem is leaders may not perhaps know the talents of the people who are around them. Sometimes we don't take enough time to chat with each other and find out what people are capable of.
Absolutely.
And that's obviously not very helpful when you're doing a delegate.
Absolutely.
And
this is also touches back on the development of leaders. How are we going to know what people's talents are unless we get to see it? How many of you before this week knew that Sam was a better singer than his dad? I didn't. But now I know that. Okay? Okay, Sam doesn't know that. How many of you were glad you weren't Mike's son this week? No, you guys did a great job. It's funny. I can talk in front of 1,000 people, but the shower is the only one that needs to hear me sing. And I'm not sure it needs to. I saw one more hand, and then I'm going to move on. Okay. I'm going to move on. Now we're getting delusional. How much should you delegate? This goes along with what Sam just said. Joe Hansen says... You delegate until they squeal. Now, what does he mean by that? You delegate until it's obvious they can't handle anymore, because how else are you going to know how much they can handle? Now, you don't make them keep squealing. You back off a little bit. But I like that thought. You delegate. How else are you going to know how much I can do unless you max me out? And then when you max me out, back off to where I'm running at 90%. But we often ask ourselves, how much should I delegate? Give them tasks until they reach their limits. The only way to find out someone's limits is to take them to their limits. That's the only way I know. I've said this before, and I don't brag about it. I have the capacity to be as lazy as almost any of you. And the thing that keeps me going is I keep taking on assignments, and when I've got deadlines, I keep going. Most of us are like that. If I said, okay, one speaking engagement a month is enough, I could blow the other 3 weeks away. I don't think I could please God doing it, and I don't think you could feel like you could either. But don't over or underwhelm them. This is for our children or for those. And ladies, don't fall into the trap that I'm just talking about elders. Remember, the older ladies are to teach the younger ladies. How much and how fast can you teach them? And I don't think when Titus in Titus 2 for the older to teach the younger, I don't think that's necessarily a classroom setting. I think delegation is a teacher. Delegating is a great teacher. It may be one of the problems, reasons we struggle with finding leaders as well as we do. Consider their abilities and limitations. I knew I had this in here. It's also in verse 21. Eldon found it in verse 25. Moses didn't ask for volunteers. I've already talked about that. Now, there are times when that's an appropriate way to go, but not always. When you delegate, follow up, but please avoid micromanagement. And I hope you know what those terms mean. You're still responsible for maybe seeing the task gets done, so you have to follow up. But nobody likes someone just looking over their shoulder. Well, no, that tape goes that way. You're not quite at 90 degrees. And that's what I found myself in. Now, the way in which you follow up is very important. And I'll give you an extreme. Well, Steve, I gave you this task, and I just came along to see if you'd messed it up yet. Well, that's not going to work. Now, a much more effective way would be, say, Steve, I sure appreciate you doing this, and I thought I'd stop by and see if you needed any help from me. I've accomplished the same thing, and I've done it in totally different ways. And Steve, or whomever, would respond differently. Common sense, but we are often devoid of that. Avoid that temptation, I can do it better. Because it's usually true. Usually you can do it better. And if simply getting the task done was our primary goal, delegation would be a stupid thing to do. But getting the task done is not our primary goal. And let me explain what I mean by that. I'm not sure if the next bullet does. Well, it gets us there. Just remember, because you're good at something doesn't mean you should do it. What I meant in my previous statement is our primary goal is not necessarily to get the task done. Our primary goal is to grow one another and develop relationships. If just getting it done is my primary goal, then I ought to probably many times bring our children into it, because you're one, building a relationship, and you're one, teaching them how to do it. There it is. Now, obviously, in the church, our tasks are important. But it's the growing of the body and the relationships in that growth that I think even often take precedence over the tasks. Vandalia's hosting this meeting. I said they will benefit more than any other congregation. Well, what is their benefit going to be? Is it going to be the words of edification from this pulpit? Well, that's a little of it, but that I do not believe is the primary benefit for the congregation. It is the growth in the relationships of working together side by side on a project. Excelsior Springs, their primary benefit will be that development of growth and relationships, not necessarily just the edifying of words. Now, I don't minimize the edifying words, but there are some things even higher on our priority scales, maybe. Jesus gave us the Great Commission. Could he have done that more efficiently? You bet. What was he doing? He was growing people and relationships. He sent out 12. He sent out 70. Could he have done it more effectively? I'd rather hear Jesus talk than any of those 70. But he wouldn't have gotten to as many places. Now, when you think about it, God is a great delegator. He gave us the creation and told us to subdue it. Would he have done a better job subduing the earth than we've done? Absolutely. What was he doing? He was growing us. Great Commission. He could have done a better job, but he was growing us. We are unworthy of God's delegation, but we have benefited from it. Maybe the people we're working with are a little unworthy of the tasks or the responsibility, but that we benefit from it. Very quickly, and I'm going to probably not have quite as much time today for our free-for-all, but we'll make up for that. I want to look at Nehemiah chapter 3 for just a moment. It won't take long, but there seems to be a little more in that chapter than I had previously gleaned. You remember, Nehemiah also was one that went back to Jerusalem. And he was involved with the rebuilding of the wall. And as you go through this third chapter, I'm not going to read the entire chapter because it's got, we don't have time and it's got a lot of long, hard names in it. But you'll see in this chapter, he appointed trustworthy men according to their abilities. He did the very same thing that I think Moses did when he selected to delegate the judgment. But he did a few other, another thing that I find interesting. Verse number 1. And Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren the priest, and they built the sheep gate. So what we've got are the priests are responsible for building the wall around the sheep gate. Now just hold that thought. Verse 10. And next unto them repaired Jedidiah, the son of Haruphim, even against his own house. So this guy's building the wall next to his house. The wall around Jerusalem. Verse 17. After him repaired the Levites, Hiram, the son of Bani. Next to him repaired Hashabah, the ruler of the half part of Kehatha, in his part. In his part means in his district, in his area, where he lived. Verse 23, you've got another man that's going to repair the wall by his house. In verse 30, another man's repairing the wall in front of his dwelling. Now, do you begin to see a pattern here? I take two very good lessons from this, at least two. Well, obviously, having these people, the priests building by the sheep gate was right next to the temple. And I told you to hold that thought. Every one of these, he's having them build something close to their abodes. So there is a practicality. But I think there may be, and I don't want to read too much into this, if you're building the wall, and it's right by your house, might you have a little more diligence to make sure it's built well? It's one thing to put in a sewer line in the next town as opposed to putting it in your street. I just wonder if Nehemiah was not only being productive in not having them have to travel very far, but he knew these people were going to have a very vested interest in what he was delegating to them. When we delegate to people tours that are of their interest and they're going to take really, really important. Some ladies would take doing the basket dinner, or that would be really something they're good at. It's close to their heart. Other people, it'd be something else, maybe doing the bulletins. It just seems to me like that's a lesson that might be worth. Jesus obviously was the ultimate delegator, and that's a little bit of a paradox. If anybody didn't need to delegate, you'd think it was Jesus. Why did he need any help? Well, the answer is he didn't need any help. But he was growing people and relationships. If anybody had the right to say, I can do it better, it was Jesus. Now, insecure leaders tend to agonize over delegating. And one of the reasons is what Janice mentioned. I think it was Janice. They don't want someone to do it better than them. Well, I'm going to ask Eldon Cox to lead the singing, but he'll do it better than me, and they may never ask me again. Well, if he's better at it than me, that's fine. Well, he is better at it than me, but that shouldn't be my approach. That shouldn't be my approach. Deacons, sometimes this is an issue, and I hope you haven't seen it, but someone just doesn't want to give up the checkbook. Now, some deacons are better at handling finances than others. I understand that. But when I see a deacon that doesn't want to handle the checkbook, I think we might have a control issue a little bit there. That wasn't in my notes. Jesus used 12 men, but he ultimately brought millions to the work. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. That's a passage which says, three are better than two. If we're alone, who can help us up? And we often use that in a marital sense, but I don't think it applies to that any more than any other relationships. It's risky to work alone. Now, we know that in the physical. I have a little power chainsaw that I don't use it except when a tree falls over our drive or when Donna tells me to do it. But I have a rule, and she accepts it. I will not use the chainsaw if she or someone's not there with me, because too many people have, even experienced people, have cut their legs, and that's bad. I don't mind doing it. I don't go up on the roof at all, but I don't go up on the stepladder without her there because people fall. It's risky sometimes to do things alone. We've all got those issues. When we fail to delegate, it's short-sighted. I think when we fail to delegate, it's often prideful. They just can't do it well enough to suit me or as well as I could do it. But when we fail to delegate, we become less effective as congregations. We do set ourselves up for burnout. I feel sorry for anybody that burns out, but I have less sorrow for someone who burns out because they won't delegate because they've burnt themselves out. And maybe the worst of all, if we're not willing to share the task, we enable inactivity in our congregations because we allow one another to not work. And we act as if that's okay. Not only is it not okay, it's not fair. And it frustrates the body. The rewards of delegation, it frees leaders to other tasks that are more meaningful. No, that are more to their responsibilities. All tasks are equally meaningful. It develops the talents of others. Why do you think Charles and Greg are elders today? Well, I don't know all of the reasons, but part of the reason is earlier in their lives, things were delegated to them, so they had to grow. And that would be true of any of you. I just chose them because I'm at Vandalia. When we delegate, it causes people that we delegate in to feel needed, productive, and trusted. Every one of us wants and needs to feel needed. A kiss of the death in a congregation is to have a significant portion of them feel as if things would be just fine if they weren't there. And it leads to greater congregational commitment. And it binds the flock closer together. Anybody have a comment or question you would like to make on delegating as it relates to leadership? If not, okay, Dwayne.
Early in my accounting career,
as loud as you can.
Early in my accounting career, I performed a job as a supervisor who reviewed the work, was critical of some of the things I did, but he told me something that was very important. He said, I can't move up until I get into the replacement. And I've never forgotten that. And I think it's important that everybody do the best they can so that other person they're doing it for can do it more important than that.
Okay, his comment was he used to work for a man that says, I can't move up until I have people that can replace me, which is a kind of a secure mentality. It could be a little egotistical. I don't know the man. In the church, we're not trying to move up. We're just trying to get more done. And I know that Dwayne meant it in that context. But our congregations can't grow unless we get all of us as involved as we can. Now I'll go back to my business meeting comment. And I don't think this is the whole answer. But I am wondering if sometimes our business meetings are not as well attended as we would like because the people don't feel as involved as they should. And maybe if we delegated a little or gave a little more focus on delegation, some of these people would feel maybe a tad more committed. Now, I will accept some of them just don't come because they don't want to come. And you can't make them come. And people that don't come because they don't want to come, in my book, have lost their right to complain about any decision that's made. And that may be an ultimate reason for having a business meeting. But it's not the most productive result of having a business meeting. When I travel around, sometimes I'll hear comments the members make about business meetings. The two most common negative comments I hear about business meetings is from some places I hear, we just never have them. Well, that's sad. I hope every congregation here has business meetings. I've gone places where I've been there for a few days and a member will say, do you know how much money we have in the treasury? I have no idea. But they'll tell me, well, we haven't had a business meeting or any kind of a reckoning of that for 20 years. Well, I think that's somebody's asleep at the switch when that happens. But the other one that I hear is we just spend 80% of our time in business meetings talking about the dumbest stuff you could ever think of and that's not important. And it's a total waste of time. Well, I don't know that I think it's unimportant, but I bet all of us have been in a business meeting where maybe 10 minutes were spent on evangelistic discussions and an hour plus was spent on what color of washer nut to put on the men's toilet. And I just made that up, but you know what I'm saying. Well, washer nuts on the men's toilet are maybe important. You don't want it to fall over, but it's so unimportant. My sons really, really, this is one of their little pet peeves. And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe we ought to delegate to our deacons a little bit more than we should and not, but be that as it may. But it seems to me like, and business meetings aren't the most important thing, but maybe they're a little symptomatic of maybe we can do a better job of getting people involved. Because it's been my experience, if they know that something at that meeting is going to be discussed that they're involved in, they tend to be there. They tend to be there. Sometimes they'll sit there and say, well, it looks like it's already been decided, so why do they even want my input? Well, some things need to already be decided, but elders, leaders, if we ask for people's input, let's really sincerely want it before we ask for it. I don't have the answer to that. If I had the answer to this question, we would have had busting buildings at all the business meetings when I was an elder, and we didn't. I'm just trying to think out loud with you a little bit. And it's a small way, but I think it's a very, very important way. Anybody have a comment, Greg, then Dave? Okay, yeah, that's something you ought to be careful of. I guess my immediate thought was, well, delegate something to both of them. And then you know, sometimes you'll hear, well, we don't have that much to do. Well, what congregation are you from? I mean, I know that we think that way sometimes, but how can we be out of things to do? Man, they're not always building oriented. But yeah, you do have to be, sometimes people can get their feelings hurt. So you need to move it around. Certainly, you need to be sensitive to that. But the easiest thing is to have something for both of them to do. Something for both of them to do. David?
You said it already, but part of delegation is empowering people.
Absolutely.
And like in the example of songbooks that you came from, the person who delegates that task needs to understand that everybody's not going to do it perfectly the way they would do it, but it's okay to not have that perfection.
Yeah. I would say if you are, I'm not really talking this week about officer selection, but if you're considering men for office and you feel like that person is a perfectionist and is going to have trouble in this, to me that's almost reason enough for not putting them in until they get a hold of that because they're going to be frustrated. If you delegate something to somebody and then you come back and nitpick what they did, you're a very foolish person. Now, if they totally did it, then gracefully help them. But usually we nitpick. Well, I'd have put 3 nails in that corner instead of 2. Well, it's going to burn up eventually when the Lord comes, no matter how many nails are in it. Okay? I'm sorry. Joanne. Excuse me. What happens when Joe and Jim don't want to be delegated to? Well, you can't force them to do it. So there's a couple of reasons possible. Either they just don't want to work, and then we've got to try to help them see how much they're needed, and there's a teaching process. Or maybe we've tried to give them something they don't feel they're quite ready to do, so that then we could say, maybe this task would suit your abilities. But there are going to be some people, no matter what we do, Joanne, are just not going to want to participate. And I don't know what you do with them other than continue to encourage them, but I want to make sure everybody that would like and is willing to, we put to work. Anybody else? Okay, if I remember right, I held you about 3 minutes too long yesterday. You have those 3 minutes back.